This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Ruslan, today we have the return of two of BFM's finest. She used to be with BFM, but she is a regular BFM contributor to this day.
So I am.
Azura Rahman.
Hello.
Hello. And he is the head of digital and new media here at BFM, and we haven't had him on for quite a while.
Yes.
Ezra Zayed.
Hello, hello.
Hello. Our three topics this week are, topic number one is, what is Brand Malaysia? Topic number two is extreme sports and midlife crisis. And people out there listening thinking, which one is that to do with? Could be anybody, couldn't it?
Could be anybody.
Could be anyway.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm 25.
And finally, topic number three is,
how do I put this? Stopping cues.
Stopping cues.
That's right.
Right. And social media. So with topic number one, what is Brand Malaysia?
Tell us, Cam.
What's
been on your mind? What's been on your mind?
It's been on my mind because in the absence of any arts funding in this country, I totally like, the recent budget has put aside 5 million ringgit.
Was it 5 million?
5 million. It's been given to an organization called Cendana, which is a private company. So mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure how that works.
Left pocket, right pocket kind of thing.
And meanwhile, down south in Singapore,
that didn't take long to get us to Singapore.
No, and I don't want to be saying it. They have an annual budget for their National Arts Council equivalent of 380 million ringgit.
Right.
And
just a bit more than 5 million.
How much does that work out, GDP, per head?
No, sure. But Malaysia is the 25th largest economy in the world,
mm-hmm.
which is not bad.
Right.
And so I was thinking, because we never spend any money on the arts, what is Brand Malaysia? Let me make it easier, okay? What is Brand Thailand? I think that's an easier one to instantly be able to say. Talking about, you would imagine graceful people. Oh, Azura's not being graceful. But I would say, the royalty, culture, cultural history, depth of cultural history. Chime in with anything if you have anything. A sense of...
You've got these wonderful beaches and sort of all of that leisure activity.
Mm-hmm. Friendly.
Of course, you've got, you know, things, cultural touchstones like The King and I. It's made its dent in popular culture at the same time. And that helps.
That helps, yeah. I mean, it is banned in Thailand itself.
Yeah.
But a nation brand would be something that's relevant to the people of that land and outsiders. And they might be two very different things.
Right.
Yeah.
So Brand Singapore. Brand Singapore would be modernity, cleanliness, efficiency, business, port.
The Monaco of Asia of sorts.
Yeah.
Wow, I'm stretching it a bit.
No, I think that for outside, especially for Europeans, when I remember growing up in Europe and people would ask me, where you're from? And say, Malaysia. And I'd say, where's that? And I'd always have to say, oh, it's next to Singapore. Oh, Singapore. Now, they don't even know exactly where Singapore is.
Yeah.
But they know of Singapore.
They know of
Singapore. I used to say south of Thailand, north of Singapore, when people used to ask me. But, you know, it's interesting that the things that you've mentioned, to start off with, you mentioned funding for the arts. Is branding inextricably linked to just culture and arts? Because in Singapore's case, you mentioned, you know, finance, you mentioned, you know, commerce, you mentioned business and modernity. And that's really not got much to do with the arts, right?
But they do manage to sort of capture culture in all of its efficient ways. I mean, they've managed to sort of snag chili crab and chicken rice faster than we can sort of put these dishes together over here. And create a story about it. And they've done so in other areas, whether it's the Formula One. They've managed to do so in all sorts of different facets. I mean, they're trying to create, I guess, the Silicon Valley of Asia. They've spread their wings pretty far and wide in all areas, but whatever it is, it's serious. There's money behind it. And they go right to the edges of it and they take it seriously as much as they can.
Yeah. And also, sorry to cut you off, to mansplain, if I may. not mansplain, but ask another question. So, for instance, batik, right? Mm-hmm. I was just having a conversation. Batik is common throughout Southeast Asia. But I think that it's something that has really been owned by Brand Indonesia.
Yes. Yeah.
Malaysia's not really been able to even grab a hold of that. Now, I was just watching a clip today, an old clip of Steve Jobs giving a talk about the branding of Apple. It was about the time when he took back control of Apple. And he was saying that with the branding, he was trying to really find the core value of Apple. And it wasn't like its hyper bit rate Pentium drive. It wasn't the technicality, because the audience would be assured that technically the computer was top of the range. They had to just know, that's just a given. But what he was looking for was, he found that Apple, he wanted it to be, was about the outsider, the genius. It was about the person who had a strange idea and took on the world because he thought he or she could change the world.
So great story.
Yeah, so he comes up with an advert where a lot of famous people are there, some of whom are alive and some of whom are dead. And he said that, well, you would assume that even though they're dead, they would have used a Mac.
Mm.
And I think that, yes, that I have a Mac, and I feel that it's imbuing, it's fertilizing
It's an extension of you.
Yeah,
it's a sharing of values, basically, right? That's why you buy a Mac, because you feel that you are a Mac person, not a PC person, right?
But what does that mean? I mean, it's a fuller experience than that. It's like when I'm typing words into the Mac, I feel like the Mac is actually taking part in that. There's a Mac-ness.
You feel that way, Ezra, as a Mac user?
Well, I mean, I think they've managed to capture the imagination of at least 80% of the people in this office. And for if that's representative.
And of course, you're the arbiters of style and
not BFM. Not in any way whatsoever. But I think what it is that certainly when you try and pursue an Apple product, it tries to sort of make that connection. And we buy into that narrative pretty easily. Mm. I mean, just even, you know, as you were talking about Brand Malaysia, I mean, we seem to come up with great, maybe sort of tactical approaches like Malaysia Truly Asia and sort of
put... Which is a great tagline.
Which is a great tagline. But I think what Cam's trying to get to the point is, what's behind that? What's behind those letters and words, and how do we identify it in the same way that could you identify, Cam, you're talking about, you know, Ferrari being as much as it waves the Italian flag in every aspect of its engineering.
The entire history of Italy is there.
The thing is, I think Malaysia does have a brand.
Go on.
You know?
Go on.
But the thing is, it hasn't really made itself distinctive amongst its neighbors. Yes, we have the food, and we talk about food all the time. You know, and
Hashtag Bersatu Pemakanan and all that.
Yeah, there you go, Ezra. Nice plug there. But also, some of the things that always stand out when a foreigner speaks to me for the first time about Malaysia. Oh, you're from Malaysia. Oh, the Twin Towers, you know. So we do have symbols that kind of form part of the Brand Malaysia story. But is it a compelling brand? That's the thing. You know, we do have a brand, but is it a compelling brand? And I feel that sometimes that you need an outsider to kind of come in and say, this is what you guys are about, and this is what would appeal to everyone else, as opposed to us like, we do batik, we do songkit, you know?
But it's also, I guess, going back to what was mentioned earlier, was would we even buy into that brand ourselves as Malaysian citizens, the ones who actually sort of go in and out of this lovely circumstance of this country? Like, I mean, can we identify whatever that is placed upon us, or are we in a position in itself to shape and dictate what that narrative is?
I think there has been a good, growth towards that affinity of buying things that are Brand Malaysia. And I speak this from my experience doing Stylefile many years ago, and, you know, there were a lot of designers who, you know, did talk about their difficulty in trying to educate consumers about, hey, yeah, it's made in Malaysia, but it's great stuff and you guys should buy into it. And you do find more and more brands saying, oh, we are proudly made in Malaysia. Yes, we are made in Borneo, whatever it is. And you guys should be proud of it too, and you should buy into it, because, you know, there's a lot of craftsmanship behind it, and we should actually celebrate that craftsmanship. So I think it's whether we have confidence in our own brand as well.
We must move on, but I agree with you there. And I think you also mentioned Made in Borneo. I think Brand Borneo is stronger than Brand Malaysia.
I know, right?
But I would say I agree with you entirely, Ezra. And I think that the key aspect of Brand Malaysia are the people. I think that if we ourselves and outsiders could possibly envision or comprehend the sheer diversity of Malaysia in one split second, all the different people, from the modernity of, I mean, there was a guy we're talking about, Julian Mokhtar, was a fantastic guitarist, like world-class guitarist, and of blues and rhythm and blues. You go from that range all the way to gamelan, and modern varieties, if you experienced it all in one shot, it would blow your mind.
Mm.
And so I think it's the people. But we've never looked at that, and perhaps it takes an answer.
And we haven't packaged it in such a way yes. where our people are being exported as one of the best.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, as individuals. So we move on. Azura.
Yeah.
Extreme sports and midlife crisis.
Not quite extreme sports.
Oh.
Extreme athleticism.
Okay.
Tell us a story.
There's a new midlife crisis. There is a story to it. But basically, it was an article that I read on themedium.com by a Paul Flannery on how getting fit is a new midlife crisis as opposed to all those, you know, tropes of
buying a Harley Davidson.
Harley Davidson, flashy car, getting a new toupee, that kind of thing, you know, facelift, whatever it is. I know, very cliche, but very true, as I find as I'm approaching that age.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the whole term midlife crisis, as a matter of fact, you know, it's actually been coined by this psychologist called Elliot Jacques. And he said that it's, as we approach middle age, we begin to realize our own mortality, and then we begin to freak out, you know, whether it's the case, oh no, you know, I've only got, you know, another 3 decades to go, or even less than that. You know, what have I done with my life? Mm. What am I doing? You know, and that's when you kind of flow into behaviors that you normally wouldn't. Maybe you're a bit more, you've got a bit more disposable income, hence you splash money on a car or you splash money on a fancy pad somewhere. But those are all things that anyone could do. It's acquiring stuff.
And is that athleticism meant to be a signal towards something, specifically mortality?
Definitely. I think, you know, when you are reaching middle age, you know, you're kind of looking to the abyss, right, more or less. You know, you're approaching the autumn of your life. So hopefully not your winter.
Yeah, you're really looking at me.
I'm just thinking of myself too, okay. You know, 39 tomorrow. but, you know, the thing is, being extremely athletic in your 40s, whatever, is really the new bragging rights. Because like all these things that I mentioned earlier on, you could acquire, you could purchase. But, you know, being fit at 40
yeah.
is something that not everyone can make a claim to. And, you know, I see this in my brother's peers. You know, he's 48 and he did his first Olympic Ironman last year.
Whoa.
And he like raced the L'Etape in France, which is the precursor to the Tour de France. Yeah.
Yeah.
And all his friends who are in his 40s and above are doing the Ironman this year, right?
So here's the thing. I think I've also, I mean, even with my contemporaries, either they've become a triathlete, an Ironman type person. They've climbed Kinabalu maybe twice in the past year. They've taken on bicycling, you know, and going up to Kuala Kubu Baru. And I don't know if it's just a circumstance of what I'm seeing on social media, because that's how we
no,
all
no, it's the claim. Real deal.
But it does look yeah. and feel like it went beyond doing tennis lessons on a weekly basis. It went beyond sort of a walk in the park.
Yeah.
I think people are taking this athleticism to some sort of either competitive aspect.
Oh, definitely.
To themselves, perhaps, rather than others.
Because you also have situations where in these triathlons and stuff, you have old people taking part and they're taking performance-enhancing drugs.
Get out of here.
Yeah, and then some of the times, they are really old people. There was this one case in France where in the 70 to 80 year age well, range,
the
guy was taking performance-enhancing
drugs. The oldest Ironman finisher is 87 years old.
And, wow.
But you'd be happy to know that even in Malaysia, happy or not, because you might feel a bit, you know, what am I doing in my life? The oldest finisher was 60 years old. And the average age is about in their 40s as well. All the participants in Malaysia that are Malaysian. And even like in the London Marathon in 2015, 40 to 49-year-old runners had faster overall times than the 19 to 30-year-olds. So, you know, it's really something that people are taking seriously.
You?
You know, I was just thinking about it, and I've been hiking for the past couple of years or so. I'm more of a weekend hiker, and I thought I was special. I thought I was doing something. Oh wow, look at me getting into nature. I've never hiked before.
Right.
I didn't do sports at all as a child at all.
Mm.
I thought, you know, I was quite special, but it looks like I'm just part of this trend.
You're
you know?
Part of a wave.
I am.
But hang on,
I'm
so
not special.
So you are identifying as midlife crisis.
I am 39 tomorrow.
So you feel a sense of midlife crisis?
I do. And it's a case of like, you know, you've got how many more good years in this body, right? Where you can do stuff, where you can climb mountains. Because I am going to be climbing mountains when I'm 70. So this is when I'm going to do it.
And you're taking you're taking back ownership and control of your situation.
And also at the same time, you know, you want your body to be healthy and fit when you are 70, when you are 80. You don't want to be like, you know, spending in the waiting room of God and like just waiting for your to expire.
Are we concerned about it not being a sort of natural aspect, or are we concerned of the fact that because others are doing it, therefore we feel compelled to do the same as a part of a larger thing that everyone in society does? I mean, everyone's been a bit more conscious about the type of food they eat, you know, being a little bit more vegan and all of these things to improve our way of life.
You say everybody. I understand.
Did you have cheese for lunch?
Something like that. I recognize what you're saying and I've seen it, but I have not done it myself. I mean, I watched the Tour de France. And that can be exhausting.
Yeah, it is.
but I have, on the other hand, certainly been through midlife crisis. I might even be still going through it now.
And what was the response?
Well, what was the response? First of all, the sensation was all the things that you've mentioned and were very eloquently put in that article that, you know, it's just, who am I? I mean, just suddenly, just sort of like, who am I? It's like a strange question. Who am I? Where am I? What am I doing? Where am I from? Where am I going to? And I think that a lot of that hyper-exercise thing is the competition, I think, would be running against death. You're competing against death. Not even the person, the human person next to you, but you're running from death. And so I can recognize that. And it was a very strange time for me. So bizarre. I couldn't understand what I was doing at any given moment.
And I think competitions like the Ironman, yes, you have other competitors, but it's really about you completing the course, you know. 16 hours on the field, you know, you swim, you bike, and then you do a marathon. What the heck is that, right? But you want to complete that for yourself.
But your hiking is, I'm going to guess it's not in the same range.
No, it's not. But I've been working out 5 times a week as well. You know,
that's your Ironman, though. That's
that
your
Ironman. That is my Ironman.
Yeah, but, right? you know, you got to be careful. My cousin died fairly recently. And he was same age as me. Hmm. And he was very fit, but he would cycle a lot. But he'd been cycling for a long time in his life anyway. But when you start doing, especially at an older age, it strains you, and it can actually expose weaknesses in your body that you're not aware of. So if you are doing it, I would say, you know, remembering my cousin, that you should go and have yourself looked at.
Yeah.
Have a look under the bonnet
to
see if the engine's actually capable of the extremities you're going to put yourself to.
I think this extreme behavior kind of applies across the board when you reach this midlife crisis juncture, whether it's an extreme facelift or like, you know, spending all your money on a car that you don't actually have money for. I think it's I think your brain just kind of goes, let's see how far we can go with this.
I think it's also about the body responding in such a way, saying, you know, I'm up for this in moderation. And yet I think there is almost that call for it to be done in this extreme measures where we can wave that sort of flag of accomplishment and achievement so that we can sort of be proud of ourselves, but at the same time receive that validation from others that, hey, you are making that drastic change. You're doing, you're just not talking about it. And it's something to be proud of, but I think it has to be sort of measured at, it's not the cost of your actual life, I guess.
Yeah, because you do it thinking that, hey, death, you know, I'm staring it in the face. And, you know, by doing this, I'm getting actually going further away from you because I'm actually fit. But
are you?
We must wrap this one up. Can I ask you one last question then, Azura? You and I are very different because you're a woman and I'm a man.
Okay, and yes, that's a biological difference.
You are a mother, you're a parent, and I am not. Do you think then that our experiences would be very different in this midlife crisis type thing?
I think so. I think there'll be a sense of measuredness on my part because, you know, I can't be climbing off mountains if I know I can't. Because, you know, I've got 3 kids at home waiting for me to come home. And, you know, there's a sense of responsibility and a sense of measuredness in whatever that I do because of that. Did you feel differently from that?
I watched the Tour de France.
And I think we might see a continuation of that behavior next year rather than participating.
That is my Mount Kinabalu.
Yes, it is.
So anyway, we move on. In a moment though, stopping cues. Going to be here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Azura Rahman, and now Ezra Zide, stopping cues. Ezra?
Yes. So in my current role at this organization, I've been sort of working with a lot of young people as 2 separate teams. And every now and then, apart from actually making sure of just checking in on whether they've completed the weights, actually checking on sort of the people themselves to see whether they're doing okay. And more often than not, I've had to have conversations with them about how their personal life is doing, and usually it's associated to their work life and their health. And, you know, a lot of our work nowadays is done in front of screens. It's done especially on the phone because of social media. And, you know, so it brought me to, I've been reading this book by Adam Alter, and it's a book called Irresistible, and it's about the business of addiction and getting hooked on screens. And so one of the peculiar things about what Mr. Alter is talking about is that in the 20th century, we had these things called stopping cues that would essentially give sort of a little knock on the door or a pause to our behavior. So if you're watching TV, you know, the credits will roll and you kind of sort of make a choice whether you want to switch channels or switch off and move on to the family table. If you're reading a magazine, the magazine would finish. The newspaper, you could fold it at the end of it. And, you know, even, you know, when it came to a chapter of a book, you'd see that white space at the end of that chapter and you'd decide, like, you know, well, let's move on from this, or let's move on to another activity. The interesting thing about what we do right now in the 21st century is that everything now is being designed to make sure that those stopping cues no longer exist, so that it sort of hooks you into this, I guess, infinite scroll experience, where when you scroll off your Instagram feed and your Facebook feed, it is nonstop, and it creates that sort of bottomless pit. So there is no stopping cue mechanism. And here's the thing, it's been designed that way consciously by sort of the tech giants to make sure that you constantly spend more time on it, so that you continuously want to pursue that particular activity. Or World of Warcraft is another great game where people spend hours and hours, and people watch Netflix, and where even skipping the credits is now an option that we take now.
Yeah, but Ezra, you are the head of digital and new media.
This is exactly
you should be happily feeding the beast.
Or be more responsible towards this kind of
behavior.
So
this is why, because of my coronal, that it's sort of taken stock about what exactly am I feeding to the masses, or how am I feeding this beast in a responsible way? Because one of the things that I was sort of thinking about, you know, how are stopping cues being introduced in our day-to-day life that allows us to give a pause to what we're doing so that our brain can breathe a little bit. So, you know, even just the notion of clicking on a link, the most immediate thing that happens when you click on a link is that there's that blank space before it loads up. That's the part of your brain where it actually pauses. So I was looking at different things about how organizations actually give you other sort of literal stopping cues. So I think there's a company in Germany where the tables filled with computers and desks and stuff, these desks are rigged up to the ceiling. And that at 6 o'clock, whoever you're writing your email to, that desk automatically goes up to the ceiling, and that space becomes a dance club or a yoga studio.
Wow.
Right? And that's a stopping cue that's of, like, you know, that's real.
Extreme.
But
imagine doing that in this office.
Can you imagine, right? Because we also can't sort of have that point in time where we actually stop work and begin our leisure time. There's another example, I think in Daimler, I think somebody can fact check that, but in Daimler, for example, if you are away on leave on holiday and you get email sent to you, the sender of that email will actually be sent an email to the company. That person that you emailed is on vacation and won't be reading your email because we've deleted that email.
Wow, they actually delete the email.
They delete that email. And if you want to get in touch with that person, you can wait 2 weeks or send the email to somebody else.
And I think in France, you can be taken to court.
Yes.
I mean, you know, and I guess this notion of stopping cues is fascinating to me because I've been wanting to figure out how else can I integrate more stopping cues into my life where it doesn't create sort of this endless cycle of just doing and doing.
You are on 2.0 because I get annoyed when I get that blank page when I'm about to load something.
Yeah.
I'm still at that stage where I'm like, oh no, come on, go faster, right?
Right.
But and I'm still at that stage where I'm infinitely scrolling through Instagram, just looking at posts. I'm almost embarrassed to admit, I actually once was on this rampage of scrolling for I don't know how long, and it actually said, you have reached the end of your feed.
No.
There you go.
I didn't know it was possible. My gosh. I screenshot that and said to myself, like, oh my gosh, it's like Ellie's gone down the... It's crazy.
Achievement unlocked.
I know, achievement unlocked.
But that's the thing. I think we're only getting a hint about what technology can do to us when it comes to addiction. I think we talk about addiction when we were growing up in terms of like heroin or anything else. But yeah. I think...
Maybe in your house.
but what I mean is I think how we're only getting a peek right now about what addiction with tech looks like. And I think... I'm not trying to sign... What was that reference? Was
okay, boomer.
Okay, boomer.
I gotta say, okay, boomers.
But it is... I think it is fascinating because, of course... You know, I think present company included, we come from that generation where we were in that transition from analog to digital. And I would like to make the case that I think for my nephews and nieces don't necessarily have that perspective of doing so.
That was imposed upon us by technology back in the day where, you know, close down would happen and then you have the Quran recital, whatever, it's time to go to bed. But that's
a great stopping cue.
Yeah. But I mean, our brains were screaming out for more, though. Constant endorphin rush. We wanted the more.
Structurally, you weren't allowed to do that.
But I wanted it.
Yeah, same here.
So now... We have it.
Yes.
And perhaps,
you're addicted.
Yeah, but perhaps people of our age are going to be facing this problem. But I would imagine that if you are born into this, then you have to find there is probably a mechanism, and perhaps you don't need a mechanism. Yeah, there'll be some deaths at the controls of the video game along the way.
Which has happened recently.
But generally speaking, I think people will have to find their own way. And you were very quiet during the midlife crisis section.
Well, the reason for that is because I think, you know, I don't think it's a case of, well, back in my day. I'm not making that argument. Because I think
sure
that
sounded like you were.
Well, the reason is because the technology is better, stronger, and faster and smarter than it has ever been. And I think we're at that threshold now where when Azura says that she's reached the bottom of that scroll pit, Azura doesn't know that. You know, I mean, Azura would have scrolled on and on and on if she
had not Instagram given me that cue.
Yes.
And I just thought, oh my gosh, what a big loser I am, right? I've been on this thing for so long. But that's where the responsibility ultimately lies in the hands of humans. You can put this technology in. You know, if Instagram had given me that cue half an hour earlier, I would have stopped half an hour earlier.
But Instagram has no interest in doing so.
But you could, I mean, Instagram could have it so that you could elect to have that and ignore it.
So the question is, do we have faith in these companies and tech giants?
Technological overlords.
To have the good faith of giving us these options?
I think inadvertently they do. I get this message once a week or so.
Talking about your screen time.
Your screen time. Your screen time is down 25%. You've been on the screen an average of 6 hours a day. Mm. I think, what? Down 25%. I'm 6 hours a day. That's insane.
And do you know what the average is? Do you know what your average is?
I don't want to know.
Yeah. Really. So I mean, I know for sure my average is about 4 hours, which is like, you know,
only
far more. Yeah, it is. It is
because you got a
life.
Job. I am. But the article that you gave us, again, very good article, and it was an interview with a psychologist talking about these issues.
Yeah.
And at the end of the interview, it says, you know, are there any practical tips? That you could suggest. And the guy basically said, I don't know, don't use it when you're at dinner.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was a bit of a...
Like, that's all you got.
Bit of a climb down, yeah. Right?
Mm. But I have to say, actually, I have made a conscious effort over the last year or so to create my own stopping cues. I didn't even notice that phrase. And to really get back into the reading habit. And it's been hard.
But it's reading, like books, you mean?
Books, yeah.
But it's hard, right?
It's
after
hard.
The screen?
But no, when you do it and you do it and you do it, then it's like, I really enjoy it again.
And you remember what it was like.
I remember what it was like.
There's a different rhythm to it, too.
Yeah, and I actually do... I can't wait to put the phone down, just deal with my messages, put that down and go read a book.
You see, the problem with me, even when I read a book, my mind would wander off to something else. So, you know, something would pop up in a book. I got to Google that right now.
I know. You have to fight. You got to. That's going to come up.
But she's hooked. She's hooked.
You are
hooked.
I am.
Yeah. But Zora, again, you're a parent. Are you a hypocrite? What do you sell your kids?
Do you deal with that screen time situation? Because
I'm doing work, guys. Can you please stop bothering me? That's my line.
Mummy cannot. Mummy busy.
Ali's laughing because he knows. He's used that line many times as well.
Don't judge me.
But
are you imposing limits for the kids?
Oh, they don't have access to my phone at all.
No, not your phone.
Do they have their own?
No, of course not.
Well, that's pretty good.
I've had friends who say to me like, "Oh, but how do you like not let them watch your phone? Watch stuff on your phone?" I'm like, "Don't tell them what the password is."
And they're not really interested then.
Of course they are.
Oh, because YouTube is a sexy beast.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so to be fair...
Are they like zombies at the door?
Okay, during holidays, that's when they get screen time, right? Yeah. And they just go silly with it. They go crazy with it. You know, they're all going like on one YouTube channel after another, and then they pretend they're like they're these influencers, you know. Oh, you're Gavin, I'm Coco, you're Ryan, I'm blah, blah, blah. So it's scary just seeing them in that state on holiday. I'm like, hello, you're driving through the wilderness of blah, 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 and you're watching something on iPad instead.
No,
and
give me back my phone.
Yes. Phone too, because I've got work to do.
The point is, we're just going to be careful about what content we create then here at BFM.
So, yeah, I mean, but you haven't. Have you solved it? Have you got a?
Well, I mean, I haven't solved it because it's an existential dilemma, which is why I'm on a bit of culture.
Well, I would say professionally, and we must move on actually. But professionally, I'd say you should be jumping on the back of this and feeding that beast, mixing your metaphors and going with the ride. I mean, you're creating content. You should be forget all that being responsible.
I'll make money.
Sure, and I'm just I think conscious about addiction stuff notwithstanding. I think there's also a question about sort of happiness. Of like, I think the more time you spend on sort of your screen, it just makes you unhappy. Like
I agree. I stopped looking at Facebook.
And I don't know what it is, but just spending time on those particular apps or on those it leaves you that sort of empty feeling. And I haven't finished the book obviously, but there's something there.
Well, I would say Ezra, what the best thing you could do is create videos that make people say, I just don't want to watch
it. I just don't want to watch it anymore.
I don't want to watch it. I've done it. Whatever.
There you go. That's a responsible head of digital media.
I hate the internet. So anyway, we move on though to recommendations, final part of the show, where we recommend something that we think might be of interest. I go first.
Okay.
My recommendation is Malaysia must create a National Arts Council. And that National Arts Council must be given 100 million ringgit per year.
Cameron for Prime Minister.
So is this a recommendation or is this a campaign that we're putting together?
This is a recommendation because...
Do you have a hashtag for it, Boomer?
I don't know. Hashtag? I don't know how these things work.
How do these hashtags work? Yeah. Do they put you into sort of an infinite scroll after that?
No, because we're behind schedule. Against the other nations in Southeast Asia, and we haven't invested any money. Even the Philippines, which is a smaller economy than ours, spends more money, and that's even after Duterte slashes it by about 60%.
It's very damning, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think brand Philippines, you'd have a sense of cultural people and culture. You would say that though of the Philippines, wouldn't you? We wouldn't necessarily say that of Malaysia. So. We need to get in the game. We need to catch up fast. And with, say, 100 million, we could really celebrate the diversity of this nation. So that's my recommendation. And Azura?
My recommendation is a series of reviews on The Guardian, which is my favorite newspaper.
A series of reviews?
Called Wellness or Hellness, okay. By this guy, Rick Samadar. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. But he's basically an out-of-work radar-trained actor. So now he just writes for The Guardian, as one does for The Guardian. So he gives his take on newfangled health trends, like aerial yoga or a sleeping aid robot or cannabis exercise classes.
Don't look at me so quickly.
So, there are all these newfangled trends that are hoping to catch on. And obviously his take is very funny, very florid turn of phrase that he has as well. And he's basically taking the mic throughout the whole thing. And most health articles or columns are very earnest. It's all about how to get fit and making you feel inadequate or whatever it is. But he just takes a real good funny jab at it, and I think it's worthwhile reading.
I think that's in line with what Ezra was saying just now. Actually, it's responsible. Because I hate I don't look at Facebook anymore because it just makes me feel bad about me. Mm. Everybody I know or even sort of know are doing these fabulous things. And I yearn for that kind of honesty that you're describing there. What's it called again?
Wellness or Hellness.
What's cannibalistic? What?
Cannabis exercise classes. So basically exercise classes that's powered by cannabis.
Well, don't we all need a little bit of that?
Okay, okay.
My goodness.
Cannibalist. What? So, Ezra.
Mine is, I've been reading a book because I saw one of those, Infinite Scroll YouTube videos, and I was sort of inspired by this guy named William McRaven. He is a U.S. Navy retired special operations officer. He was part of the Navy SEALs. He was involved in catching Saddam Hussein and, saving Captain Phillips. He's done all of these wonderful things, and he's got a book called Sea Stories, My Life in Special Operations. And it's basically, talking about Azura and somebody who goes through sort of athletic extremities, you realize quite quickly about not just sort of the physical prowess that these machines have to do to
cyborgs.
To essentially save lives and do all of these amazing things. But there's a mental aspect to their achievements that is sort of really quite amazing. And it involves, amazing things like saving lives and hunting terrorists and all that kind of stuff. So, Sea Stories by William McRaven.
Yeah, but can he scroll to the bottom of his Instagram feed?
I don't know.
That's the real test.
Sure.
That's the extreme sport these days.
I've got that on him.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so, sorry, what, again?
The book is called Sea Stories, My Life in Special Operations. It's by Admiral William H. McRaven.
Ooh, hoo-ha.
That's exactly it. Hoo-ha.
Okay, so that brings us to the end of this week's show, the middle-aged edition.
It did sound a bit like that, didn't it, Boomer?
But that's that's what you have to do. You got to accept it. You got to just.
You got to embrace it, Ezra.
Yes,
you're going to be there.
You are there.
Oh,
that's
easy,
not,
guys. Easy.
I don't deny it. Anyway, please join us next week. Oh, sorry, I got to thank these people, haven't I? Thank you, Ezra Zayed.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Azura Rahman.
Thank you for having me.
And myself, Cam Ruslan. And please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.